One man who has the ear of President Obama on health care is Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a surgeon who also teaches at the Harvard School of Public Health. He says the debate over how to pay for expanding coverage to the uninsured has focused on only two options, raising taxes or rationing care. But Dr. Gawande says there's another way to save money. He and several colleagues studied communities all over the country that cut healthcare costs significantly.
Places like Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Asheville, North Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, Sacramento, California, Temple, Texas. These were the places that turned up to be these positive outliers. And what's going on in these places was what we have been ignoring, I think, in the debate and also in just our thinking about what we want to do about healthcare.
Some of these communities stopped paying doctors to perform more procedures. Others kept that model, but they all had one thing in common.
All of them have found ways to try to blunt a financing system that only pays doctors for doing more procedures and pays us very little for actually just spending time with people. And if we had a system where other cities were doing what they were doing, our healthcare crisis would be over.
Dr. Gawande told me how Cedar Rapids cut costs.
The physicians got together and said, you know, let's just look at how many CT scans we're doing for our city. And they found last year that they did 52,000 CT scans for a town of 300,000 people. And they said, whoa, this is embarrassing. And we want to do something because we just don't need that many expensive CTs. And actually, CT scans have 1,000 times the radiation exposure of a chest X-ray and can be harmful. And they did indeed find that the vast majority were finding just normal findings, that you had people getting scans that didn't necessarily have to have them. And so we need, on a national level, a payment system that rewards communities like Cedar Rapids for doing that, just for looking and seeing, are we doing too much back surgery here? Have we taken care of our cancers well? We want to take what's happening in Cedar Rapids and reward every community for doing that.
And how do you reward them?
On a simple level, one of the provisions that are in a few of the bills is paying physicians for their quality of their care, rewarding them by saying, if you look at the data, if you measure yourself, and if your results are improving over time, you'll actually be paid for that.
We keep hearing in this sort of debate about healthcare overhaul, we keep hearing the word rationing being thrown around, and it sounds scary. But what do you say to someone who sort of wonders whether cutting back on procedures that you would argue are unnecessary is a form of rationing?
If there is any government or insurance company that is making the decisions about whether you need a CAT scan or don't need a CAT scan, that is both bad medicine and rationing. If what you have is a physician who you have a relationship with, taking care of you, and they're just making good evidence-based decisions about the right kinds of recommendations for you, that is rational care. And what we've been missing in the system is rational care. The irrationality turns up in all kinds of ways. It turns up in the physician who wrote to me describing a situation where he's a part owner of a imaging center. They started losing money because the doctors weren't doing enough CT scans, and he found that they were in board meetings where they were sitting around trying to figure out how they get more people to get more CT scans. It had nothing to do with it, whether they had good care or bad care for those scans. And that's the disaster of our system, is when you have medicine become a business rather than something about what the patient's needs are.
But I mean, couldn't doctors make the argument that they're entitled to be paid well and maybe not just limited to receiving a salary, but to receiving money based on the services they provide?
I think that we are well compensated and that we're very lucky to live in a country that has valued the services of the medical profession so highly. There is nowhere else in the world that values their medical profession as well, and I think we have found real advantages to doing that. But whether it is a salary or being paid a fee for each time that I take out a gallbladder, I still am in a country where we are well compensated, and I think it will continue to be that way.
The issue that comes up a lot is lawsuits, medical malpractice. And doctors, many doctors argue that they're doing these tests, even if they may seem unnecessary, to protect themselves.
Yeah, I've been a fierce critic of the malpractice system. The defensive costs are probably part of what's going on.
The insurance costs.
Yeah. So in other words, physicians ordering tests because they're afraid someone will sue them, even if they don't think it's the right thing to do. The only reason that I don't think it's the linchpin is that we have these communities that are already producing better quality care at lower costs and doing it in the context of a system that still has our malpractice problems.
Dr. Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and an associate professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Gawande, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
First, it was the Episcopalians. Now, it's the Lutherans. The Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, one of the nation's largest Christian churches, may be on the brink of allowing gay clergy. More than 1,000 clergy and lay people will gather in Minneapolis on Monday. They'll be deciding whether to change policy and permit pastors in gay relationships to serve in the ministry. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty has our report.
Why, you ask? Why should I listen to another story about gay clergy? I wondered that too, but then I realized something remarkable has happened. This once incendiary issue has become, well, humdrum. And with breathtaking speed, at least for the 4.6 million baptized members of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Consider the story of Bradley Schmeling, who pastors St. John's Lutheran Church in Atlanta. Early on, he told his bishop that he was gay, but not in a relationship, which was okay by church rules.
In 2004, I met Darren Eastler at church, just like your mother wants you to do. And our relationship progressed, and it became clear that this was a relationship for life. So I did go and tell the bishop.
The bishop asked Schmeling to resign. Schmeling's church reacted differently.
They all clapped, and their immediate interests were, what was he like? Where is he from? I had to kind of remind them that there would be consequences for the relationship.
For Schmeling's job and possibly for the church. Soon after, the bishop filed charges against Schmeling in a church court. And in February 2007, the jury said that the policy was unfair, but rules are rules and Schmeling should be removed from ministry. St. John's kept him on, which was a risky decision. If Schmeling remained in the pulpit, the church could be kicked out of the denomination. Schmeling's trial ignited a debate that has been smoldering for years. At the National Assembly a few months later, the Lutherans passed a resolution saying the bishops did not have to enforce the rule barring gay ministers if they didn't want to. No one knows how many bishops looked the other way, but people on both sides believe there are at least a dozen or two churches with, quote, irregular pastors. And now, the pro-gay lobby is gaining momentum, less through bomb-throwing than just wearing the conservative opposition down.
Most of our people are, frankly, tired of the struggle, but I don't think we want to give up. I know we don't.
That's Reverend Paul Spring, who heads the Lutheran Coalition for Reform, a group that opposes the ordination of clergy in openly gay relationships.
There's nothing personal attached to this at all, but it is a biblical concern. What does Holy Scripture teach about marriage? What does it teach about family? What does it teach about sexuality? It's very clear there is no support within Holy Scripture for this kind of relationship.
Those wanting gay ministers disagree. They say Jesus was all about including everyone in his work and mission. Now that disagreement is being put to the test, and it looks as if the liberals have a good chance of winning. And so conservatives like Paul Spring are already preparing to create a new church within the ELCA with its own constitution, education system, and rules for calling ministers.
So we intend to remain technically within the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, but practically we will become a de facto synod.
As for Bradley Schmeling, he'll attend the assembly as an observer since he's no longer recognized as a minister. If his side wins, he says he'll apply to be readmitted to the church, and he hopes he'll move out of the spotlight as a national symbol.
So I'm kind of looking forward to just slipping back into obscurity and being a regular parish pastor.
Of course, the 1,000-plus participants in the assembly can vote any way they want, and they could dash Bradley Schmeling's hopes. But even conservatives believe that change is inevitable, if not this year, then at the next assembly in 2011. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
You asked for a new round, so we're back with 3-Minute Fiction. For those of you who were away earlier this summer, we asked you for original short stories, fiction that could be read in 3 minutes or less. That's about 500 words or so. And you sent us more than 5,000 submissions. 2 weeks ago, James Wood, the New Yorker's literary critic and the author of the book How Fiction Works, picked a winner, a story written by Molly Reed of Fort Collins, Colorado. You can read her story and the runners-up at npr.org/3-minute-fiction, and that's 3-minute fiction all spelled out as one word. And James Wood is now back with us to introduce a new round. James, welcome back.
Hello.
So we were thinking a lot about what made the winning story stand out in the first round, and we noticed some very compelling first sentences. And I was wondering, have you ever asked a famous writer about an opening line and whether they struggle with that sentence?
I once asked Richard Ford about the first line of his great novel, The Sports Writer, which begins, "My name is Frank Bascom, I am a sports writer." And he told me that it actually came very easily to him, and he always knew that that was going to be the first line. I think if we look at manuscripts of novelists or short story writers, say Raymond Carver's manuscripts, you can see that a writer like him struggled enormously with first sentences, mm-hmm. and sometimes that these were changed by his famous editor, Gordon Lish.
How important are they? I mean, there are great novels out there with first lines that are not memorable.
Yeah, there are, I think, probably many more novels whose first lines we don't remember. I think for a short form like the one we're doing, it can be very useful to a writer as a sort of organized, almost like a title, as an organizing principle. And, of course, is the introduction of a voice. That's the crucial thing, a certain kind of naturalness.
Well, you're foreshadowing our next round. But before we do that, I'm going to offer some inspiration, James, to our listeners. We asked a few colleagues here at NPR to read some classic opening lines from literature.
I was born twice, first as a baby girl on a remarkably smogless Detroit day in January of 1960, and then again as a teenage boy in an emergency room near Petoskey, Michigan, in August of 1974.
Call me Ishmael.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
That was NPR's Frank Langfitt, Ari Shapiro, Susan Stamberg, and Corey Flintoff reading the opening lines from Middlesex, Moby Dick, Pride and Prejudice, and Anna Karenina. So, James, inspired by these lines, for the next round of 3-Minute Fiction, we have a new twist.
We do. The idea is to begin a story with an arbitrary first line set by me. I'm responding here to something that the French poet Paul Valéry expressed as part of his hostility to fiction. He didn't like the fact-filled nature of realism, and he used to use as an example of complete arbitrariness, "The Marquise went out at 5 o'clock." That for him was everything that was pointless and arbitrary about fiction. I wrote about this in How Fiction Works and sort of turned it on its head and showed that as soon as a second or third sentence follows, that's to say, as soon as we ask the question, where is the Marquise going, why was she leaving at 5 o'clock, what's next, it becomes less arbitrary in the way of fiction. So in that spirit, perhaps we might respond to Monsieur Valéry.
Oh, please.
And we shall try to write a story that begins with the sentence, "The nurse left work at 5 o'clock."
The nurse left work at 5 o'clock. Okay, got it.
The struggle will be to make that admittedly arbitrary first sentence into something natural. So we shall see what happens.
So let me throw out some rules for round two here. The story has to be 600 words or less, not a word over, and only one entry per person. And for this round, we have to receive the story by Tuesday, August 25th, by 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, the story, James, has to begin with your sentence, "The nurse left work at 5 o'clock." You can submit your story by visiting npr.org/3-minute-fiction with 3-minute fiction all spelled out, no spaces. James Wood will read the winner's story on the air, and he'll send you a signed copy of his book, How Fiction Works. James, you haven't made it easy.
We're definitely kicking it up a notch here.
That's James Wood of The New Yorker and our judge this round in 3-Minute Fiction. James, great to talk to you, and we'll check back in a few weeks with you.
Look forward to it.